So are you underpaid, overpaid, or paid just right? If you're not thinking you're getting paid what you are worth, what can you do about it? We'll address the issue during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, financial planner Kevin McKinley has some tips on figuring out how much life insurance we need and investment advice as the Federal Reserve considers reducing the quantitative easing program, and answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with us every week at this time for information and advice on your money. He joins us from our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So, Kevin, when's the last time you gave yourself a raise?
The last time I received a salary was for a few months shortly after getting out of college. And so how much money I make or don't make is pretty much dependent on a little bit of skill, lots of hard work, and a little bit of luck.
Yep, we work hard for the money. But not surprisingly, though, in this survey, many of us think we're worth more than we're paid.
Yeah. Yeah, a survey by Spherion Emerging Workforce says that when asked, does your boss pay you what you're worth, 44% say yes, but 56% say no. Now, in the survey, they didn't say, are you being paid too much? So maybe these people say, I'm being paid way more than I'm actually worth. And what we mentioned last week is that productivity, especially in the United States, is outpacing the increases in income. And people are noticing that. They're seeing the company's generally making more money, and they are not participating in it, especially if they work for larger employers. The Hay Group says that the average raise in 2013 was about 2.8%. Mercer says next year it'll be about 2.9%. But if you are one of those higher income and higher stressed workers, you're probably going to get a bigger bump. They say it's going to be about 4.6% increase in 2014. This might be a good time, though, to check with your boss and see if there is a way that you can make more money.
Is it as simple as just asking?
It can be, actually. But what does not work is talking about your own needs, like I need more money, or I have kids in college, or we just bought a new house, or the Bears didn't cover the spread over the weekend. Mm-hmm. That's not a good reason. It's better to schedule a meeting with your boss. List your accomplishments, make sure you have some and have them in hand so you can discuss them, and then ask and say, I think I've contributed a lot to the organization. I'd like to make more money. Is it possible now to get a raise? And if the boss says, no, I can't afford to do it right now, or you don't qualify for it, say, well, what can I do? How could I make more money? What do you need to see from me to get this increase in pay? And then document the meeting yourself so you can just have your notes down in front of you. And then as you reach those milestones set for you by your boss, if it's possible, note those and then schedule a follow-up meeting, usually 6 to 9 months after your original meeting.
And if the answer is still no dice?
The best way to get what you want in life is boils down to one word, leverage. Mm-hmm. You need to start looking around for another job now. And as we mentioned last week, you may find out that you actually are fairly paid and there aren't many other jobs for you out there that pay more money. But you might find another job that is a similar job or one that you can make more money at. And then if you want, you can either take that job or go back to your boss and say, hey, no offense, I know you said I couldn't make any more money, but if I take this other job over here, I can get an increase in pay and et cetera, et cetera. And because I want the increase in pay, I may be forced to take it unless you can help me out here. And the only downside of that is you have to find a job like that. And the second thing is you have to be prepared to leave. You can't bluff and just make up some other job miscellaneous at Vandalay Industries.
All right. So if all fails.
If those fail, it's time to start cutting down what you spend and seeing if you can actually net out more every single month. And one of the best ways to do that will be to listen to On Your Money on October 13th and 15th when we are having our ever-popular pledge shows and giving away free to anyone who pledges at any level our most popular mini money book, 50 Ways to Save. And we are throwing in 10 extra ways to save $50. And we're doing that because October 2013 marks 10 years since the first episode of On Your Money aired on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, happy anniversary to us.
Assuming we get there. Let's just hold off. See, we got two more shows before that. Anything can happen.
But wait a minute. 50 ways to save 50 bucks, but it's really 60 ways to
save. Yeah, there's 60 ways to save $50. So let's see. It's multiplied. It's $3,000. That's a pretty good deal.
I think that we should make it 60 ways to save $60. No, that's all right. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, call us now at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for the On Your Money email bag, and it has been rumored that the Federal Reserve may soon reduce their quantitative easing program, and we have a listener who is concerned about what that might do to his bond mutual funds. Ed writes, "Hi, Kevin. I often work in Wisconsin and enjoy your commentary. I have a question about bonds as part of my investment portfolio." He goes on to say that bond funds currently make up about 28% of his portfolio. Although they have performed well in the past, he has concerns that interest rate rises affecting bond values, and that has him spooked. And he wonders, is this a good time to reduce his exposure to bonds? And if so, why? Kevin?
It can be, but it depends on where the money would be going. The Federal Reserve's quantitative easing program, this is a strategy they use to allegedly bring the economy out of the doldrums, boost confidence again, and help the financial markets repair themselves. What they were doing is buying bonds in the open market to the tune of about $85 billion per month at the latest rate. And that would, in effect, lower interest rates, help investment in markets, boost the economy by making money cheaper to borrow, especially the housing market. Mortgage rates were affected in part by this, and that helped boost the housing market back up. But lately, there's been some concern over several parts of the program. One is the cost of the program versus the actual benefit. And so that what the Federal Reserve is talking about doing is very soon is reducing somewhat the amount of bonds they're purchasing every single month, which in effect should cause interest rates to rise.
So how does that affect bonds and bond mutual funds?
We've already witnessed it. They were mumbling about this back in June, and as soon as it happened, bond prices fell, which caused interest rates to rise and also caused bond mutual fund prices to fall in general. And some of that money went into safer investments. Other money went into stocks because people perceived there being a better risk-reward proposition in the stock market than there was in the bond market in the time of falling bond prices. And so we'll see if it actually comes to effect now. Nothing may happen. It may already be priced into the bond market, but if there are more significant decreases in the quantitative easing program, there could be further pain to come from bondholders.
So should Ed be spooked about his bond funds?
Right. He can be, and it's good to know if you are going into a bond fund that, first of all, they definitely can lose value, and especially when interest rates rise or risk means that the inherent in the bond portfolio means that some of the bonds may not be as likely to pay off, or like we've seen in the last few months, people perceive that there's a better alternative out there. Whether they're right or not, we'll see. But when rates rise too high, there's really nowhere to hide. Rising interest rates hurt both stock prices and bond prices when they rise too much, and we saw that throughout the 1970s when interest rates were very high. So if you do hold on to the bond fund, you can do it, but definitely expect the possibility of more loss and definitely more volatility. And if you're really worried about it, you're looking for a safer place to hide, but still need a little bit of income, look to certificates of deposit, especially if you go directly to institutions to purchase them, because those generally have very little market risk to them. There's typically only a penalty if you pull the money out early for it. And yes, you're not going to get more than 1% or 2%, even if you go out several years, but the downside of those CDs is much less than most bond funds.
Yeah, so Kevin, is there concern that interest rates are going to rise too high too fast?
That could definitely be an issue, and it could be something that's effective. We also have several other issues going on with this. There's another budget ceiling ready to be broken. We've got a change in the possible chair of the Federal Reserve position going on, so there should be plenty to talk about over the next few weeks.
And you can talk to Kevin McKinley right now at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our first caller is Dave in Milwaukee. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, my wife just gave birth to our first newborn, and we're wondering, should we open a college savings account or just a regular savings account for the baby?
Congratulations.
And, why one would be, thank you. And why would one would be better than the other?
Yes, Dave, congratulations to both you and your wife, and kiss all that sweet 8 hours of sleep goodbye for the next 8 to 10 years. You are right to be thinking about this right now. There are a couple things that I'd like you to look at before college. One is setting up your estate planning, getting wills, guardians, and life insurance in place. We're going to talk about life insurance later on today. And after you've done that and you're looking to save your bouncing baby's future, I'd actually like you to start with opening Roth IRAs for yourselves first. Do you have those right now, Dave?
No, I don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd like you to start with Roth IRAs, because if you are eligible for them, Roth IRAs are a pretty neat trick versus saving for college, because you can save for college, yes, but you can also borrow money to pay for college at some point down the road, and you cannot borrow money to retire. So you definitely put retirement as the first priority ahead of college. And the second thing about Roth IRAs, as both of our longtime listeners know, you can pull the contributions out of a Roth IRA at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. That's the contributions. So if 18 years from now, your brilliant, above average, gifted, and talented child is ready for college and doesn't need any money, you can channel that towards retirement. And if he or she does, you can actually pull the contributions back out and use those to pay for college. Now, finally, if you do just want to save for 529, and as some people need to do it for tax reasons, other people do it because it's their only best option because of their income, use a EdVest plan through Wisconsin. At least start with that one, because you get a small tax break on it. Go to edvest.com, EDVEST.com, and Wisconsin residents will get a small tax break up to the first $3,000 that they put into that.
Okay, Dave?
Thank you.
Hey, Dave,
thank you.
What's your baby's name? Oh, I'm sorry. I guess we're losing our connection with Dave.
Well, Joy, we do have a policy at On Your Money that anyone who does name their baby after me, we put $50 into their college savings account. So just think about that.
So Kevin or Joy, Dave, we are talking about your money on your money. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, is here to answer your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Coming up on the show, Kevin has some advice on figuring out how much life insurance you should have and some tips on why we should consider doing away with cable television. And of course, answers to your personal finance questions. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for him, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Margaret in Seymour is with us now. Hi, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask Kevin, on my husband's 401k plan, that is with an administrator, which I'm not too pleased with. They put it into a lifestyle mix, and I'm only getting like 3% on the money. The money is invested with Vanguard, but I don't care for the administrator. Is there any way I can move that money? And do you have some suggestions of where it'd be best to do?
Sure. Margaret, why are you unhappy with the administrator?
Because when I call, all I got is young kids on the phone. I can never get an answer to what I want.
Yeah, I'm finding that too, Margaret. It's one of my issues. They used to be about my age, but the kids keep getting younger all the time. Well, yes, is your husband still employed at this place of work?
No, he's been dead a number of years now.
Oh, okay.
A retirement fund, you know, and it bounces around to different administrators, whoever want to pick it up, I guess.
Sure. So. Well, Vanguard generally is pretty good, but they're a very low-cost provider, and one of the reasons they're a low-cost provider is that they can't provide a lot of service and hand-holding. But they do, in my experience anyway, they do a remarkable job for being a low-cost provider. But that said, were you thinking about moving it to like a bank or a credit union or something?
I was thinking, I had talked to the banker, but I don't know how that would work. If they want me to put it into things that they would like, I would still like to be in Vanguard with the money.
Okay. Hard to be in Vanguard and not be associated with them at some point unless you find some kind of financial advisor who is also willing to put the money with Vanguard. And the nice thing about that is hopefully you'd have the financial advisor who would deal with you face-to-face and is hopefully older and provides you with a greater level of comfort. If you're going to be moving it to the bank, be careful because a lot of times in this situation, the bankers have an incentive to put it into an annuity. And while you may like an annuity for some reasons, I'm not a big fan of them for most people, and especially in this situation. So if you were to move it just to a CD at the bank, you're not going to get very much, but it is going to be very safe and it's going to be reliable. And more importantly, you'll know exactly where it is and you'll understand it completely. If you want to put it into something that some investment advisor offers, keep in mind that they're probably going to pick something that's going to bounce around, as you say, just like this Vanguard Lifestyle Fund. So ask them and say, you know, can this go up and can it go down, and how much can I expect to lose in a down period? And if you're not comfortable with that, you might be better off just using one of their certificates of deposit. And you can definitely do it. And when you set up the account at the new institution, Margaret, they'll take care of all the paperwork for you, transferring it out of Vanguard, getting your signature on all that. And if they aren't willing to do that for you, find somebody who is willing to do it.
What if I went to like a private fellow to handle it? Are there anybody you can suggest around this area?
Not offhand. I don't know enough about what other people do in their fields of work to recommend anybody, but I would keep in mind that you want someone who's hopefully, I prefer fee-based financial advisors. That doesn't mean a fee-based one is going to do the best job versus a commission-based one, but it does remove some of their incentive to recommend a particular investment.
Do you remember offhand that website to find a personal finance advisor, Kevin?
There are several up there. You can go to NAPFA, NAPFA.org, and then there's, if you want a certified financial planner, the CFP board has one as well, and we'll put those links up at onyourmoney.com so that if Margaret can get on the web, she can find someone in her area through those search engines.
She can find a private fella.
For her lifestyle.
Margaret, thank you, and good luck to you. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you would like to ask Kevin a question. Amy in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is your question?
I just wanted to ask Kevin, I'm only 27 and I'm in sales, and I've had a really good year this year, and I've been saving most of my bonuses, and I was thinking I wanted to invest in property like a condo with my boyfriend. I just don't know if that is the best idea. I know interest rates have gone up, things like that. I just wanted to know for people who are under 30, if you have particular things that you think are smarter investments.
Well, congratulations, Amy, for having such a successful year. And what should she do, Kevin?
Well, get back to work. Don't sit and listen to the radio all day. You're going to blow that bonus right out of the water. Are you doing this, Amy, because you want to own a condo, or are you doing it because you think it's a good investment?
I guess both. I mean, I also, right now, I'm paying quite a bit for rent in Milwaukee, and it just frustrates me that I'm paying so much without owning anything. It's kind of like wasted money in my view, but
I understand that. You also will waste a bunch more money whenever you buy your first house or condo, as all the homeowners and condo owners out there can attest to. It's just, you feel like it's yours, but it's really not. It's the banks. And the minute the price drops, the amount of your down payment, you actually are upside down on it. So you don't even own anything anymore. So if you're doing it for something you want to just have your own place, it's predictable that you can customize yourself, I could see that. I'd prefer you buy a house. One of the things you'll find out about condo ownership is generally condo ownership has all the bad things about renting an apartment and none of the good things. You can be really on the hook for the association fees. And so if you were going to buy a place, I would definitely want you to wait until you were able to, because you'd rather purchase a standalone home probably, right?
At some point, but where I'm going to be living, I'll be moving to Nashville in probably like a couple months. So, you know, I won't probably live in the suburbs at that point yet, but at some point, yes.
Okay. I definitely say then wait, because if you're moving, a lot of things can change. If you're moving by definition, that means, you know, you've got a job that you're doing really well at, you may make more money on it, but it can change and you may need to move someplace else. So if you're not going to be in the same place for at least 5 years, you definitely want to keep renting and not owning a home, because what you'll find is that not only the down payment, the closing costs, all the other stuff will eat up any potential gains probably that you might have, especially in a condo over a 2 or 3 year time frame. And I wouldn't want you to be stuck with that thing when you get your next promotion.
Mm-hmm. That's good advice. I appreciate that, because we probably won't end up staying in Nashville for more than 5 years, I'm guessing. So I'd have to sell it pretty quickly.
Maybe you could buy a motorhome.
Well, Amy, I hope you will be coming back to Wisconsin soon.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We now go to Karen in Milwaukee. Hello, Karen.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Approximately 2 years ago, my position was eliminated after about 30 years with a system. I was given my retirement amounts at that time, the money that I had accrued, and what I believe is an annuity, because I have a guaranteed monthly income to me, or I can have the lump sum. I was given the amounts, and a year later, I just left them where they were just to get settled in. I found a new job. But a year later, I received a letter saying that they audited my my account and my monies, and they were found they calculated it wrong. My lump sum amount decreased a fairly good amount. Is this legal? Can they do that after they've given you that amount in writing?
Probably. And it happens just because whenever – it's one of the reasons people are moving away from these kinds of pensions, because at least with your 401k, for better or worse, you know exactly how much is in that account on any given day. Whereas with a pension, lots of different calculations and actuarial assumptions can change, both in terms of where the company's at and then also in terms of – what the law requires and the financial global environment. So it's not rare that this has happened, and it's one of the reasons why, even though it seems like taking a check a month from a pension like this is a good idea at first glance, after you get into it and you say, well, how long is this company going to be able, or this organization or entity going to be able to keep paying me this money? And the longer you live, the less likely it is they're going to be able to keep paying it. So that's why in most cases, I lean towards a lump sum, especially if it's really the only larger sum of money that you have. It's better off to take the lump sum out. So have you given any thought to that, Karen, as to which one you'd take?
Well, monthly amount looks good, you know, if you calculate it out, if you think, well, gee, you know, I hope I live to be 85. I mean, that monthly sum looks great.
Right.
But I am concerned because there have been more changes within this company. And so I'm thinking I need to get my money out and put it somewhere else.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and that's the first inclination is that you add up that up and say, well, gee, even if this just stays the same for the next how many every 25 years, it'll be way more than I can earn on the lump sum, and that's actually part of the problem. The people running the pension generally have the same constraints and limits that you have in terms of trying to manage the money yourself, and one of the reasons that they're promising this extraordinary amount is they're using a rate of return that's probably higher than I think they'll be able to get and what most people can get on their own over the next 20 or 30 years. So it kind of stinks to have to take that lump sum out and give up on the big check. But offhand, I'd rather have you do that. And again, especially if this is the biggest portion of your liquid net worth.
Okay. And even though I'm age 59, it's still good to do that with a lump sum.
Yeah, you can roll it over into a qualified IRA at any provider like a Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity or your local bank or an investment firm or whatever. They'll set up an IRA for you, get all the paperwork in, and assuming there's no limits put on a rollover by the company, they can move the lump sum over into that new account. And if it goes over without you cashing the check, it's tax-free.
Thanks for the call, Karen. Good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin is here just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. If you have a personal finance question for him, our number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for Smart Assets. September is National Life Insurance Month, so we are going to spend some time discussing this uncomfortable but important topic. Kevin, are we generally set for life insurance or not so much?
Not so much. Most people are in the wrong on their life insurance. They either have not enough or they have too much. Or they have the wrong kind, or they're paying too much for it, or they've purchased it at the wrong place. So we'll talk about how much people generally need, who needs it, where it should be purchased, and for how long you should maintain it.
Okay, well, let's start with how much.
The goal is to make whoever's left after you are gone financially independent. And again, we'll base that on what you spend each month. So take what you spend in a typical month plus any other big planned expenses. And typically for, let's say, a younger family with small children, this might be college, and add it in there. So take 200 to 300 times your net monthly expenses. And then add in those big ticket items. So if a family is spending, let's say, $4,000 a month, and they have two kids, let's figure $100,000 each for college costs. 200 times 4,000 is 800,000. And then put another $200,000 in for college, carry the 7, divide by pi. That leaves about a $1 million net that should be left if the parents should not be around to provide for those kids. Now, if you have a lot in savings set aside, that can obviously diminish the amount you have. But again, most younger families don't have that much in savings, so they need to replace all of the income with life insurance.
Wow. So that's the amount that should be on the life of the breadwinner?
Yes, but you also want to have quite a bit on the stay-at-home parent if there are two parents around, if possible. And the reason being is that some people say, well, you know, I work outside the house and she doesn't, so we don't need any life insurance in her. I'd like to give the working parent, if that is the case, the one who's actually earning the money, the option of staying home and taking care of the kids and not having that be a big financial loss for the family as well. So you wanted to have it on both the breadwinner and the stay-at-home parent, if that is indeed the case.
And if they're both breadwinners, have it on both?
Yes, definitely on both.
Yeah, so isn't that going to be expensive, though, to purchase that amount of life insurance?
Not if you buy the right kind. And the right kind for almost everyone who's in this situation is term life insurance. Typically, a 35-year-old male can buy a $1 million term life insurance policy for about 20 years. And if they're in good health, it costs about $50 per month. And a female in the same situation costs about $35 to $40 per month. You can get it to last almost as long as you want. And many term policies can be made permanent at some point in the future. But you at least want to have it in place until the kids are supposedly independent and maybe take you into retirement as well if you have a partner or spouse for whom you are providing. So 60s and beyond for the grown-ups.
What if you don't have kids, Kevin?
Get some. because that really helps the life insurance industry. No, you actually still need it because, again, you probably have debts that might need to be repaid. If you are in a relationship, you hopefully want to provide for that person and to replace income. Now, if you're just single and without any children, then I would say you don't need life insurance unless you do have a significant student loan burden or you owe a lot of money to people who are relying on it, such as your parents. You might want to have a life insurance policy as a courtesy to them to make your loss only or the loss of you only emotional and not financial.
Mm-hmm. Where should we buy our term insurance?
Not where most people buy it, which is at work. About a third of people who have term insurance only have a policy at their job. And the problem with that is that if they leave their job for whatever reason, a lot of times the insurance does not go with them. So you're better off getting policies on your own. And consider getting a few at separate different companies to guard against the default of one of those companies. And you may want to ladder or stagger the terms of the insurance. Maybe get one for 15 years if you've got an 8-year-old at home to take him or her into support. So-called adulthood, and then maybe another one for 30 years to take you well into retirement. The best website to shop for term policies is termforsale.com, T-E-R-M, the number 4, and sale, S-A-L-E.com, termforsale.com, and we will have that up at onyourmoney.com later on.
Sounds good. Speaking of shopping around, coming up, we will talk about cable TV and why we might want to consider doing away with our cable television. That's coming up in our Shop Around segment. Right now, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Stacy sent this email. My husband and I are big fans of the show and now find ourselves needing some advice. We're both 35. We both max out our 401k and contribute monthly to our two rainy day savings accounts. We have very little debt and we'll have paid off our house in 12 years. Now we're about to have a baby. What should we do about life insurance? Should we open a life insurance policy or put that money into a savings account or an IRA or a CD?
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. Could you start over with that one, please?
They're going to have a baby.
They're going to have a baby. Okay, I got that. That's the most important part. Congratulations. These are the kinds of people who should just be pounding out kids for our own benefit, financially independent. Please contribute to the Social Security. Have the kid get a job, contribute to Social Security so Joy and I can retire comfortably. I would much rather have them purchase the life insurance than put it into a savings account or an IRA or a CD. And they are definitely people who not only can afford but should get term life insurance. They should stop paying down their mortgage any faster than they need to. They should have term life insurance probably for at least $1 million on each one of them. And they should have wills, guardians, and an empty trust set up. The empty trust should get the proceeds of the life insurance policy should something happen to either one or both of them so that the kid doesn't get the $2 million when he or she turns 18. It can be managed a little bit better and bled out slowly as he or she needs the money and is justified in taking it out. So that typically involves a trip to a lawyer. You can do it at a place like LegalZoom.com, but they can afford it and they should get some good qualified help from a real live person.
Way to go. Congratulations, Stacy. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for our Shop Around segment. As a part of our series on how to spend less and get more television programs, we're talking about cutting the cable cord. And Kevin, why should we consider this?
Well, first of all, don't do this literally. You still have to pay the bill,
right?
And then you don't get the programming. So don't actually cut the cord until you've eliminated the service. A lot of people are thinking about doing it. About 7%, according to the Diffusion Group, of people who have cable are thinking about cutting it in the next 6 months. They say they're going to cancel it. And last year was the first year that there was a net loss of cable subscribers in the United States. And with an average cost of $86 and ranging up to $200 just for the broadcast portion of the cable. It's doubled in the last 15 years. It's expected to go to $200 per month by 2020 by the NPD Group. There's more time to buy this program, put it together yourself, and get a much better deal than paying this for cable if you're so inclined.
Yeah, so why do you suppose so many people are figuratively cutting the cord?
I think it's because they want to save money and because they can. They can start by getting access to over-the-air broadcast. This can be, you know, the normal rabbit ears, but you're better off going with a newer kind of antenna. There are usually a few channels in every single market, about four or five major networks and some ancillary channels, but they are free. Some people might say, well, wait, I have 800 channels right now. How can I go down to four or five channels? 22 of the top 25 most popular programs, the ones most watched in the United States, are available over the air for free. Now, not necessarily in every single home because the antenna has to be able to get that program, but 22 of the 25 most popular programs are available for free over the air right now. And there's a website called GoMohu.com. They make a kind of a square updated antenna. It costs about $40. But what's even better is at GoMohu.com, you can type in your zip code, and they'll tell you which stations and networks you can get and at what channel over the air for free on your proverbial rabbit ears.
Go Mohu. All right. So what else, though? What can be done to fill up the rest of our viewing needs?
You can start with movies via that red box that sits outside of lots of different stores and Walgreens, etc. But an easier and cheaper way to go is by streaming the content. And Hulu and Amazon, H-U-L-U, provide great services for a very low cost. Many of the networks now are doing their own streaming online, and even YouTube is trying to get into the programming area. They're not quite up to speed yet. Most of it is still just, you know, people taking the cinnamon test or whatever. And if you want to watch that, good for you. Even retail stores like Walmart and Target are starting to offer streaming. Walmart has Vudu, V-U-D-U, and Target has just announced they are coming up with Target Ticket to compete. But all of those services take a backseat to the rest of to the leader out there.
What's the leader?
The leader is Netflix with 36 million global subscribers. The plan costs anywhere from $8 for a basic streaming plan up to $12. And with a $12 per month plan, you can have four simultaneous connections at any time. So if you want to spread it around your house or among your friends and family for $12 per month, you can do that. It has thousands and thousands of programs, adding more all the time. They just started adding original programming that was very critically well received. And go to Netflix.com. The first month is free. And again, it's only $8 a month for that. And one thing that you might want to consider if you feel like there's just not enough content on there is you can subscribe to Hulu Plus, Netflix, and Amazon Prime. And it will average out to about $23 to $25 per month, depending on which service you go to, which, again, is way less than what you're currently paying for cable. And you will get a lot more programming than what you probably have at your fingertips and a lot more desirable programming than what you have with cable or dish.
I am so behind the times. This sounds really good. Is there any downsides to streaming on your TV?
Yeah, you need two things. You generally need a high-speed data connection, and you need some kind of a device to get the programming from the web to your actual television screen. So we'll cover both of those areas next week.
Sounds good. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Here to answer your personal finance questions, whatever they may be, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Chris in St. Croix Falls is with us now. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Joy. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Well, Chris, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm an insurance agent, actually, and I just wanted to kind of offer up the reality that taking someone who may have, you know, $30,000 to $50,000 or even a couple hundred thousand dollars from an employer to convincing them or encouraging them to ramp up to $1 million in life insurance is a challenge, to say the least. And what I find to be a little more realistic approach is to take what really would boil down to some realistic life decisions in a case like the loss of a spouse that perhaps now you really don't need two car payments and some things are actually changing and the expenditure can reduce in some meaningful ways. There are also some ways that it may increase with some additional child care costs and things like that. But to take someone to that level is difficult in the marketplace today with the demands of everybody's budgets. And what I find to be the case is that oftentimes that you try to take somebody to that level and it just turns them off, and you're doing them a disservice by doing that, when in reality, if you bring a more palatable number to the plate that would keep the economic hounds at bay, but perhaps wouldn't facilitate life as we know it now, and unfortunately life isn't as we know it, and maybe $300,000 to $500,000 really keeps the boat afloat, but doesn't float it in quite the luxury that it once did.
All right, Chris.
It's a more realistic approach.
Oh, you want to react to that, Kevin?
Yeah, Chris proves that there are good and decent, thoughtful licensed insurance agents out there. So thank you, Chris. That's correct. What I find, in especially with people who don't look at the big picture when they're trying to offer life insurance to people, I'm not saying Chris does this, but other agents, I've seen this in the past, they only come to people with cash value life insurance, which can be a useful tool in some cases, but it's generally much more expensive than term life insurance. And when people get a request to, say, buy $1 million of cash value insurance, that's when the sticker shock really hits. So term, as we've established, even $500,000 for a middle-aged couple, $500,000 each can be had for generally probably about a total of about $60 per month. And if you can't afford $60 per month, you probably need the life insurance even more than someone who can afford it.
Thank you, Chris, for the call. We go now to Sue in Wausau. Hello, Sue.
Hi, Kevin and Joy. My question, I was self-employed for a few years and started a simple IRA plan. Now I've gone back to a regular job and have an employer-based 401k. And I'm considering or looking into rolling over that simple into the employer-based 401k. Is that advisable? My other option is to start to transfer the dollars out of it into a separate Roth IRA I have.
Okay.
But I'm just curious to what would you advise?
If you move it into the Roth there, of course, you're going to pay taxes on it, correct?
Correct, correct.
Okay, and are you in a low enough tax bracket, or let's put it this way, are you making more money now than you will in retirement?
Yeah, probably a little bit more.
Okay, then I wouldn't...
I'm 59 and a half, too,
okay.
So I could actually start pulling out of it, but...
Okay, that's a good question. I would have you. I wouldn't have you convert it just yet. I would wait till you're done working, and hopefully before you begin initiating Social Security payments, if you can afford to, keep a window in there, and that's usually the best time to make the conversions from a taxable IRA or SEP IRA or 401k account into a Roth IRA. Now, the advantages of moving the self-employed plan into the 401k are really just that. You know, you have it all in one place and you can keep a better eye on it. The disadvantages, of course, is you're limited to the roster of the 401k, of the funds within the 401k, whereas with your self-employment, your SEP IRA or whatever it is, you can choose from anything, including like certificates of deposit or what have you. So is there another advantage to moving that into the 401k that I'm missing?
No, I mean, one of the main ones was just to consolidate it into one place, but I've also been disappointed in how the funds are doing in the current simple SEP IRA. They're in a American funds mix, and they just haven't really performed very well.
So, okay.
But what I hear you saying is I could talk with the financial person that's helping me manage that and try to move that money into some better performing kind of fund.
Sure. And this is something that a lot of us get caught up in. When we're talking about performance of investments or mutual funds, we only have one number that we can rely upon, and that is what it has done. We don't know what it is doing nor what it will do. And there is a phrase that John Bogle, who's the legendary leader of the Vanguard funds, came up with called regression to the mean. And regression to the mean means that investments that have gone down tend to go up, and ones that have gone up tend to go down. So be very careful about getting caught up in things that have done well or haven't done well. That doesn't mean you can't switch or shouldn't switch, but it just means that moving out of one that maybe hasn't done well into one that has done well in the past, you may be doing jumping out of the frying pan into the fire based on what might happen in the future. But yes, it is possible. But I don't mind American funds. They're relatively low cost for a for a sold financial product. They're not as low cost as, like, say, a Vanguard, but they are relatively low cost. So you might want to look at funds within the American funds, and then by doing that, you can avoid paying a new sales charge on moving into some new family of funds.
Sound good, Sue?
Okay. Okay. All righty. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good luck. Sally in Prescott is our next caller. Hello, Sally.
Hi. Thanks for all the good information, Kevin. I have a whole life policy that's accumulated a decent amount of cash value. I'm 73, and since I retired, I have stopped paying into that whole life policy. I would like to take that cash value out now. Do I need to pay capital gains on that, and what would you suggest I do with the cash?
Well, I don't suggest people rush off to buy these things, but once they've had them, and once they've had them for quite a while, which I'm guessing you've had this for several decades, right, Sally?
Yes, many years.
Okay. This is the point where these become a pretty good deal based on your life expectancy and the cost you're paying for the insurance, and that's part of what the cash value is reflected. Now, is it a variable one, meaning like is it invested in mutual funds, or does it pay you a fixed rate of return?
I believe it's fixed.
Okay, check on that fixed rate of return, because I'm guessing if you've had it for a while, that rate is probably around 3-4%. And that's
it
not.
It is, and it's paying very good interest. So I'm thinking, why take it out of there, except that each year as I get older, it gets higher, you know, for the cost of insurance. And I think it's going to wipe away my cash value.
That's actually probably will happen, but there's probably not another investment out there that you could put it into that would provide that rate of return with this level of security. Now, it's not as safe as a certificate of deposit, and there are expenses, and eventually it will eat at the cash value. Is there anyone relying on your death benefit? Do you have a spouse or family member?
Nope, I don't need the whole life policy anymore.
Okay, you don't need it. Offhand, as an investment, I'd probably keep it for the time being. Unless you have a strong need for the money, or you feel like you can go out and buy a CD that pays at least that same dollar amount, it's a fairly conservative investment. And yes, you will pay taxes on the gains accumulated over generally what you paid into it. And so I would rather have you hang on that and get that rate of return for the time being until something better comes up.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you for your great advice.
That's the only kind we give, Sally.
Sally, thank you for your great question. Here's another great question. Gerard emails, what exactly is the difference between term life insurance and whole life insurance?
Term is basically for the term. You pick a term that you want to have this insurance coverage for 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it is. Whole life is generally a cash value that's permanent. It stays in place as long as you pay the premiums for it, and it may even earn you some dividend, and as Sally mentioned for it. Term is usually much, much less expensive, and therefore for people who are just trying to provide for the loss of a breadwinner or a stay-at-home parent's services and income, term is a much better solution.
It's time now for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, when you get all this programming from all these different sources, its question is what to watch. And I'd start here by going aside with a show that I would highly recommend On Your Money listeners take a look at. And the show is on ABC, and it's called Shark Tank. And the season premiere is September 20th. And what it is, it's a great family show for any kid who has an interest in business and entrepreneurship. Someone with an idea or product or a service or a company goes in front of 5 millionaires or billionaires, presents the idea and the product, asks for money to invest in the product, and then the 5 people decide if they want to invest it. They argue over who gets to it. They offer different terms for it. And we've watched this show ever since it's been on. And the kids love it because they figure out what products make sense. And it kind of inspires the little lemonade stand operator. So Shark Tank is one I would definitely recommend you take a look at it. But if you're really wondering where to go, a user at imdb.com put up a list of all the top rated shows available on Netflix, all the different series that are available. You can click right through to each one on Netflix. It's at imdb.com, but there's a long string on it. So we'll put a direct link up at onyourmoney.com later on.
Thank you very much, Kevin. So time for 4 more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, here just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. Kevin will be back next week. If you have a question you'd like to email us, the address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. Thanks to Bill Mertens and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.